What does the forest whisper with every wind-stirred leaf, from many centuried oak tree to our old blossom sheaf? What does the forest whisper when nightingales are dumb and cicadas fall silent? The forest whispers, come. What does the forest whisper in sunshine and in shade, down every moss-hung alley, in each deer-haunted glade? What does the forest whisper when full or crescent moon steeps nodding crests in silver? The forest whispers, soon. So that's a poem by Sangharakshita called The Call of the Forest. And for me, that's a poem that evokes the sense of going forth. And it evokes the call of the wild, which we all have a sense of somewhere deep down, which is sort of constantly beckoning us out of narrow domestication into a wider, more wild and free way of living. So in order to illustrate what going forth is in the tradition of Buddhism, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the story of the Buddha and his early life. So some of this, you know, this is a legend. So, in terms of historical accuracy, there's a bit of leeway, but it's nevertheless a very important story in its own right. So Siddhartha, sometimes he's called Prince Siddhartha. He was certainly born of a noble family to a powerful clan in northern India. And around the time of his birth, there were certain auspicious signs and auspicious dreams, which gave his mother and father reason to believe that this was going to be a particularly significant birth, a particularly significant child. And so the parents, around the time of the birth, they summoned a soothsayer, you know, as was the custom, summoned a local seer to come and see the child and to tell them what was the meaning of these auspicious signs. Who was this child that was coming into the world? And this local soothsayer came along. Perhaps he looked at some entrails, and he talked to the mother and father, and he interpreted the signs. And what he said was this: this is a very special child, this is a very important child, and he will grow up to have a particularly significant effect on this world. What this means is that you will be totally elated that one day he may become that powerful ruler that you dream of. He may continue your legacy of powerful king. However, and there is a but, if this child, if this young man sees the suffering of the world, if he sees the harsh truths of existence, then instead of continuing this line of powerful kingship, he'll go forth and he will become a holy man, and he will then lead people in the way which leads to the end of suffering. He will lead people out of suffering rather than leading armies into war. So for this reason, as you can imagine, the king, his father, had a lot invested in keeping Siddhartha in a very safe and luxurious context and protecting him from the harsh truths of reality. So for the early part of his life, up to the age of about 17, Siddhartha lived a life of luxury. He lived in a palace full of lotus ponds and beautiful, attractive young people. And he lived in surrounded by gold and surrounded by silks. And he lived this life of luxury with parties and lots of fine wine. You know, I'm sure you can imagine. Probably quite bourgeois by today's standards. But all of the things which were harsh and unpleasant, the unpleasant truths of existence, were hidden away from him. They were sheltered. They were kept outside the palace walls. That's where all of the dirty people lived, really. All of the people without money who had to scrape a living. They were all kept outside the palace walls. And what this meant was that Siddhartha didn't have a sense that anyone really had to struggle. And his world was kept looking nice and luxurious by his parents. And around the age of 17, he became married and had a child, we hear. And so he was very happy and a young man living a life of luxury. However, for some reason, some unknown reason, something was stirring in young Siddhartha. Yeah. There was something important about his life, which he had a sense, you know, there's more to life than this. You know, and perhaps that thought, there's more to life than this. However fantastic, however wonderful it is, however exciting and ecstatic my life is, there is more to life than this. And so one day he was walking around and thought, well, this is amazing, but, you know, those are really beautiful golden walls, but I just wonder what's beyond those. And so, unbeknown to his father, he summoned a very loyal servant to him and said, okay, 17 now, I want to go outside of the palace. I want to see what's on the other side of those walls. And of course, his servant was really quite sheepish. He thought, oh, I'm not sure about this, might get in trouble with the father. But he was very loyal to Prince Siddhartha, so he said, all right then, let's go. But he thought, I'll keep close to him in case he sees something he's not going to like. So outside they went, out of the palace walls, and they were walking around. And Siddhartha, well, I mean, he was a bit like, what on earth are they, you know, what on earth's going on here? Where's all the silk? Where's all the gold? You know, why are these people covered in mud? Why are they shouting about fish and carrots and things like that? I thought, well, what's all that about? But as it turned out, you know, he wasn't just disgusted by it. It was actually quite satisfying, to see something perhaps a little bit more real, perhaps a little bit less airbrushed. So he was walking around with his servant, and then he turns a corner, looks into a house, but what did he see? There was a woman lying in the house on a bed with the door open, and she was tossing and turning and moaning, and she was probably sweating, yeah? And then there was a man near her, looking after her, mopping her brow, trying to comfort her. And Siddhartha was really quite disturbed by this, so you can imagine. He perhaps his body started to tremble a little bit, or he just felt a really unpleasant sense in the gut. And he thought, what on earth is that? What on earth is that? And so he said to his servant, what on earth is that? And the servant said, well, that's that woman's sick, Prince. Like, that woman's sick. And he said, sick? He said, yeah, she's not well. She's got pain, and she's feeling ill at ease. Yeah, and she doesn't know what's going to happen to her. And so Siddhartha said, well, that's terrible. You know, someone must do something about that. And he said, well, you know, because we're all so lucky that that's not happening to us in the palace. That's not going to happen to us. But his servant pointed out to him at that occasion, this is going to happen to us. Yeah, this is going to happen to me. It's going to happen to you. And Siddhartha was extremely disturbed by this, yeah? Extremely disturbed. So he sort of thought, okay, let's just keep going. And they had to kind of keep going around the palace so they could get back to the gate. So they kept going around the next corner. He saw this sort of wrinkly figure sort of stoop down, wandering around like this, bending on a stick. And Siddhartha said, what the hell is that? What the hell is that? Okay. And his servant said, well, that's just an old man. It's an old man. He said, you know, what's an old man? What's an old man? And so his servant, loyal to him, told him the truth. So this old man, you know, he's like you and me, but he's 40 years later, and he's stooped with a stick, and his bones are hurting, and he won't be living as long as we are. Yeah. He said, that will happen to us as well. And so you can imagine Siddhartha was not reassured by this truth. Okay. So he said, well, let's come on, I want to go back to the palace now. So they turned the last corner. On turning the last corner, they heard this, they saw this really weird sight of this kind of inanimate body being carried on the shoulders of these guys walking out, and they were chanting, and there were some people wailing. And he said, what the hell is that? And they said, and his servant said, that is a dead man. He said, a what? A what? And the servant said, that man, you know, he's lived to a good age of 80, but now he's dead, he is no more. And Siddhartha said, wow, that's poor guy, that's a pretty terrible thing to happen to someone, he said. And I, you know, this whole thing, you know, today's been a real learning experience, but I'm ready to go back to the palace now. Thanks very much. You know, this whole thing about sickness and old age, it's good to know this stuff. You know, I'm gonna think about this. I'm gonna try to make my life better. But at least that's not gonna happen to me. Yeah, at least not gonna happen to me. And his servant broke the painful truth to Siddhartha. So back in the palace the next few nights, Siddhartha was not relieved. He didn't get a lot of sleep over the next few nights, tossing and turning. Yeah, he'd seen these things and they'd rocked him to the core. And he realized that not only was he going to be sick, not only was he going to grow old and eventually die, but this was going to happen to everybody who he knew and everyone he held dear in the world. And it occurred to him that there was an absolute necessity at this point to somehow find resolution to this pain. Yeah, somehow find resolution to this deep unease and this deep suffering which he was experiencing as a result of seeing the truth of his life. So he said to his servant again, right, today... Yeah, we need to go outside. I can't stay in this palace anymore. I can't sleep. All I can think about is these people I've seen. All I can think about is that. So the servant took him outside. And they were wandering around again, seeing the people selling carrots and fish. And then in the same marketplace, he came across this very strange figure who was just, he was just standing there really amidst it, you know, and a few people were giving him food. And he had these sort of muddy rags that he was wearing. And for some reason, whilst all of the drama was going on all around, and all of the people there were just sort of going about their business, but in a slightly, maybe a slightly frazzled, slightly frantic way, and troubled by their concerns, very strongly troubled by their life concerns, this man was just standing in a very serene manner. And it was almost like he was giving off a particular quality of serenity and calm, which was just infectious. And Siddhartha, you know, he saw him and he caught something from him. Yeah, he sort of saw something about this man, which I know somehow is an answer to what I'm looking for. How on earth, you know, because he doesn't look overly naive. He doesn't look like he's sort of naive or ignorant. But somehow he's able to remain very calm and serene amidst all this really, really mad life and suffering that's going on around him. Okay, so that's the first part of the story of the going forth, and it is called traditionally called the four sights. So Siddhartha sees a sick person, an aging person, and a dead person, and then finally sees what is at the time a wandering ascetic, perhaps someone who went and lived in the forests or practiced meditation with teachers, and was there was a tradition at that time in India of people leaving home and searching for the truth, searching for this through higher states of meditation. Searching for an answer to this problem of worldly existence. So what does it mean? You know, Siddhartha didn't just see these things. He didn't just sort of see them with their eyes, because we've seen, you know, we've all seen Casualty and we've all seen Holby City and we've all seen these things. So it's not like he just kind of got an idea. He didn't see, you know, we even some of us have been to funerals. He didn't just see these things. He saw them with the whole of his body, you know, in such a way as he fully empathized, perhaps, with the suffering which was going on. He saw himself in a way which wasn't separate to those people. His suffering was not separate to their suffering at that time, if only for an instant. So that's what the quality is of the sight. It's a deeper vision, yeah, of the suffering of human beings. And this vision that suffering is inextricably linked somehow with our own. Yeah. And interestingly, one interesting aspect about the palace walls is you've got this idea of a really comfortable existence, yeah, whereby everything's happening within a particular space. But somehow, just outside, touching those walls, but just on the other side of those walls, there's a kind of truer version of existence where there's also a lot of suffering going on. And it's quite interesting, this was in his early life. His family were protecting him from the harsh truths of reality. And if we look at our own lives, even if we weren't, even if we weren't born into noble families, I think that's one thing that parents do, which is a really positive thing, because we need to grow up in a healthy manner. But also part of the job of a parent, perhaps, is for a while to protect, to protect their children from the harsh truths of existence. And then we slowly grow into adulthood and we slowly start to see more and more that that's one side of the story. There's more to life, and some of it's not nice. It made me consider also how in our society, particularly in our society, we're very, very lucky to have a very good social care and healthcare system. And what that means is that people are looked after, people who are subject to sickness and old age, and also death, they're looked after and cared for in a way which is much, 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 much better than in lots of parts of the world. What it means, though, is that our life in this society is very similar in a way to what Siddhartha's life was like, in that we only really see those aspects of life if we go to those places, yeah? And in ancient India, some of the ascetic practices involved actually going to those places to encounter those truths. So some people would go to sort of cremation grounds and see the truths of death for themselves. And whilst on the one hand it's a very positive thing to be, not constantly shocked by those things, however, we don't see them. There's a sort of clean, very, very nice clean white walls on the hospital. Yeah. So Siddhartha saw this, and he saw it in such a way as he couldn't unsee it. Yeah, it had now profoundly affected his life, and he couldn't change that. He couldn't change his direction. He was on a course. I'm going to read a bit from the book "Who Is the Buddha" by Sangharakshita, and this is about the four sights. The event which shatters one's private world is very often unpleasant. It may be a bereavement, or the loss of a job, or discovering the infidelity of a spouse. On the other hand, the breakthrough can come about in a more agreeable fashion. You get a sudden insight through art, perhaps, or music or poetry. Then again, it can occur through an experience that is neither pleasant or unpleasant, nor even sudden. You just get discontented and dissatisfied. But whatever serves as the tripwire, the experience which follows tends to be painful, disturbing, and consuming, because the old patterns are disrupted, the old moulds are broken. This is the sort of experience that Siddhartha had, as illustrated by the four sights. And I think this is something that, probably many of us can relate to. So it made me think as well that at the age of 12, I had these experiences of beginning to get a glimpse of the fact that I was going to die one day. I think this is something which is quite common for lots of people in their childhood, at some stage realizing that we're going to die and that the people around us are going to die. And I remember at that time, I thought, right, how am I going to sort this out? This is really not okay. How am I going to sort this one out? How am I going to resolve this in my mind? So I was, thinking about it and kind of not getting to sleep. So what did I do? I went and spoke to my mum. And so my mum was great. She did exactly what a mum should do, and I really appreciate it. She put me at ease and calmed me down and said it'll be okay. Yeah. Which was great. It's exactly what I wanted to hear, And it, you know, it, and as a result of that, it was all right for a while. However, it kind of didn't go away. So sort of, you know, 21 years later, I'm still trying to kind of answer that question. And so I think this is something which is common to all of us. And I'm not suggesting that we should kind of dwell in morbid fascination about these things. It's not like that. But we also shouldn't necessarily assume that when these things that come knocking on our door, these truths come knocking on our door, assume that either there's no answer or there's no way of answering those things. And we shouldn't assume that the best thing to do is to overlay them either. Yeah. But we do need to find a way in which to answer those things. And that requires perhaps a context. Perhaps that requires a certain kind of examination or exploration. And in order to explore that, we might need the help of other people. One thing that's the case, though, and it's very clear, is that there is no solution to these problems on their own level. We cannot try and fight death. Yeah, we can't say, we're not going to die. Right, I've made my mind up now. I'm sorry it's happened to you. I'm sorry it's happened to you. But I've made my mind up now. It's not going to happen to me. And I'm going to take extra vitamin supplements, and I'm going to drink lots of protein powder, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can so that this doesn't happen to me. And unfortunately, on that level, at some stage or other, the harsh truth breaks through, and it will happen to us. Yeah. Nevertheless, there is an imminent need for an answer. Yeah, we can't also just say, oh, well, it's going to happen to me, and get sort of depressed and morose or bitter about it. So there does seem to be that there's something in us that constantly asks the question, well, what on earth am I going to do? Yeah, how on earth am I going to live my life if it's the case that I'm going to get sick, going to grow old, and going to die? Yeah, what am I going to live for? What is the point? And I think we should take those questions seriously. I think actually we can trust those questions even if we don't necessarily know an answer to them immediately. Trust the questioning. There's some sort of conscious or unconscious yearning in us, yeah? And even perhaps that yearning has a seed of knowing in it, that there is somehow, in some way, a way of answering that need. And this is where the fourth sight comes in. So Siddhartha encounters a stranger. He encounters a person who is not like other people. He's not operating in the same manner as other people around the marketplace. He's not lost in the drama. He's a person who appears to be, you know, he appears to be encountering life, but is on a different trajectory. Yeah, might even have a quality of beyondness. Yeah, beyond this world. And also sort of considering that, you know, Siddhartha is not just encountering a person, he's encountering a whole new manner of being in the fourth sight. So what this might be is that this man, you know, he might well be existing and living and experiencing life through a clearer, more vivid sense of awareness. He might be experiencing a sort of higher level of consciousness more regularly, and his awareness might be imbued with sort of positive, calm, and rich qualities, which can have an infectious effect on people. Yeah, and sometimes, what can happen is that on encountering someone like that, that something of their quality of awareness, something of the quality of their world and the richness of their world, can break through the barriers or break through the smoke screens of our own personal understanding of the world and affect our life. So another quote from Sangharakshita: beyond our present mode of existence, there are other dimensions of being which we can grow towards in a way that is inconceivable to our present sense of individuality. So the wanderer, yeah, the fourth sight, the wandering ascetic, represents this truth. He's someone who is, yeah, in touch with other dimensions of being, which are beyond our own present individual understanding of the world. But we can see it in someone else sometimes. So sometimes, I think it's common for us to have experiences of meeting people whereby on a particular encounter, we know that something's affected us by that meeting, and our life somehow will never be the same again. Yeah, even if we forget about it, even if we decide to go down another route, nevertheless, we will always have the memory that that person somehow changed our mind in such a way as life will never be the same again. And again, I think that that's something that largely we can have confidence in, whilst also continue to follow in a way which is intelligent and questioning. Yeah. So we shouldn't necessarily assume that because someone has a very strong effect on us, that we can, you know, completely wholeheartedly give our lives to them. That's not what I'm saying. We have to always be cautious of, testing within our experience, and in relation to our friends, in relation to people, how much can I follow this person in such a way as I know it's going to be good? And that brings our own, that brings through our own wisdom and our own sense of emotional independence through that, yeah? So we have to test it over time in an intelligent way. So it occurred to me that one thought I'd have is that the four sights, for those of you who are familiar with the spiral path in Buddhism, the first two stages of the spiral path are dukkha and shraddha, so seeing of the unsatisfactoriness of existence. And in dependence upon that, there arises shraddha, or faith. So it occurred to me that, for those of you who are familiar with these, that the four sights might be a sort of story-like illustration of that. So that the Buddha first sees dukkha, yeah, he first sees the unsatisfactoriness of life, and he's able to stay with that experience, and stay with his experience enough that at some stage, what it gives rise to is a seeing with the eye of faith, and also a seeing of something within which he can have faith. And there's something interesting also about the story in that it's just there's a readiness, of Siddhartha. He knows that the question is of imminent importance to him, and he knows that he needs to find an answer. And somehow, for that reason, life conspires to show him something, reveal something to him, which he can have confidence in. So as a result of this, Siddhartha saw that he needed to change his life. Yeah, he needed to change his life completely. And Siddhartha chose to leave home, and he chose to spend the rest of his life exploring for an end to this suffering, looking for an end to this human suffering. So one way that we can look at this, this going forth, this leaving home, this radical change of life, without necessarily, deciding, although, not ruling it out, to wander off and in the way that Siddhartha did necessarily. However, we can look at this going forth in our own lives in such a way as we're looking at it from going forth and changing our lives, and going forth from the group. So what does this mean? So again, this is some of Sangharakshita's thinking about the going forth in relation to the group. So what Sangharakshita says is that there are these strong forces at play in our lives. Yeah, we are strongly influenced by our relationships with other people. Yeah, in an evolutionary sense, we have grown to depend on one another for our very, our safety, our security, so that we won't get eaten by wild animals, that we'll have enough food on the table or whatever came before tables, and so that we know that we're going to be safe and cared for in old age. Yeah, so for this reason, we have incredibly deep instinctual patterns of behaviour and relationship with one another, which cause us to influence one another so that we all stay safe. Yeah, and stay kind of tight in a comfortable group. And this would be fantastic if that's all we wanted to do with our lives. But it seems to be that, there is more to life. We do have this sense that there is more to life. And we all have this sense somehow that there is more to life. There is this individual freedom that we want to experience in our lives. It somehow seems confined by the expectations of the group that we're part of. Sometimes it can be the expectations of our family, what they expect for us from our lives, or the expectation of our boss, or even close friends. Sometimes we feel like they don't really know this part about me, or there's more to my life than just this. But for the sake of safety and approval, sometimes we're willing to just compromise on that and just keep it safe, because I don't want to rattle. I'd rather keep everything safe, and I'd rather keep, say, my relationship with my brother nice and neat, so that he doesn't feel threatened by what I'm doing with my life, for example. And how can this feel? Well, an example of how it can feel is almost as if we're walking around among the people who we most strongly associate with, but it's almost as if we're wearing a mask. It's almost as if we don't want to show them, and perhaps they don't want to see something of the truth of what we're really like. Or maybe it seems like maybe there's something about me that's really unacceptable or ugly, which I can't possibly share. Yeah. So I think, again, that's certainly something that I recognize in my life. And it also might be that, the wider group of society, so we can end up living a very conventional life whereby we're subscribing to conventional norms of human behavior. Yeah. So we're saying, okay, right, I don't know what to do, but, I don't exactly know what I want to do, but it seems like, everyone's going off and getting a job, having a career, getting a house and car and family. Well, that's maybe what I need to do to make me happy. It certainly seems to be what my parents want me to do, so maybe I'll just do that anyway. And it's not to criticize that per se as a choice. It's just that, are we making that as a free choice, or are we making that choice on the basis of that's just what's expected of us? So it's really looking, am I basing this choice to live in that way on what I want for my life and how I want to most affect the world in a meaningful way? So what does going forth then mean in this sense? So going forth means slowly changing and transforming our lives to align with what is most meaningful to us as a human being and the unique individual. And we do this with or without the approval of others. So that's going forth. Yeah, that's leaving the narrow confines of the group. So now a little bit about what we're moving towards. So Siddhartha, after going forth, spent years exploring with different teachers and examining his experience. And he found that he couldn't find an answer through these means to his deep sense of unsatisfactoriness, deep sense of disturbance that life isn't okay. And finally, he decided to sit beneath the tree and made a vow that he wouldn't move until he'd seen what needed to be seen. And so he did. He sat beneath this tree, and again, as part of the story, something happened, yeah, or something was revealed. And what was revealed was had the irreversible effect of changing the trajectory of Siddhartha's life. It meant that he then saw that it was absolutely necessary for him to help other people to see the world in such a way as he saw the beauty, perhaps, of what was revealed to him was an antidote to the world's suffering, and also the wisdom that had arisen in him was an antidote to this disturbance. So he then dedicated the rest of his life to attempting to and effectively communicating the way towards that vision and transformation which had occurred in his being. And this path then was a further going forth into the world, and this continued to shape his life for the rest of his days, and it continued to shape the world around him, and it continues to shape the world today. So about 2,500 years later, as we're trying to embody these qualities of freedom in our lives, we're trying to move out of our narrow, restricted confines of group behaviour. What is it that the tradition has handed down to us that we can aim towards? Yeah, it's all very well leaving home, but I for one am very grateful to have something, have a way of operating which is going to turn me towards something that I can have confidence in, that I can believe in, and in that way transform into. So that in Buddhism there are three central principles which are emphasized, particularly in our tradition. And these are seen as three central principles that we go for refuge to. Yeah, we can find refuge from our suffering in. So the first, so these are seen as three jewels, okay, three jewels, three precious qualities right at the heart of Buddhist practice. And every single Buddhist practice that we engage with is, could be described as a way of reorientating our lives and to align with these central qualities. So the first quality, the first principle is called the Buddha principle. Yeah, it's the quality of the awakened being, the awakened heart. Yeah, the Buddha principle represents the greatest potential of all humankind and also the greatest potential for ourselves. Yeah. It's perhaps a state of boundless creativity, limitless compassion, wisdom and skillful action, and stillness of mind. So we orientate ourselves towards the Buddha jewel, and we try and realize that more and more in our lives through our actions. We try and act as an enlightened being would do, and try to help others to grow in that way as well. Then there's the Dharma principle. So the Dharma could be seen as the teaching of the Buddha or the truth revealed by the Buddha. It could be described as the essence and means of communication of the truth of the way things are. The Dharma can also communicate itself in terms of poetic truth, through poetry, through art. Yeah. It could be described in poetic terms. Sometimes it might be described as the Dharma as the boat that carries us to the other shore or the way to the beyond. Yeah. And the third principle is the Sangha. And the Sangha is the fellowship of those people who are dedicating their lives to practicing the way to enlightenment and practicing the teaching of the Buddha. We could also consider the Sangha as a sense of community, fellowship, but we could also see the Sangha as the Arya Sangha, meaning the Buddhas and enlightened beings existing on a different plane of experience from our own. In our tradition, there's a very important aspect of spiritual friendship called Kalyana Mitrata. And this is friendship which connects us with what is beautiful, what is noble, and what is auspicious. And we can orientate our lives towards the Sangha jewel by dedicating ourselves to practicing friendship and dedicating ourselves to bringing out what is beautiful, noble, and auspicious in our relationships with other people in our lives. And sometimes, we can sense through practicing that this deep sense of connection with other people, which has somehow a sense of timelessness to it. So these are some ways that we can look at the three jewels. These are what Buddhists are trying to orientate their lives towards. And these are the opportunities. Yeah, this is an opportunity to reorientate our lives towards these. So I'm going to finish with the same poem. The Call of the Forest. What does the forest whisper with every wind-stirred leaf? From many centuried oak tree to our blossom sheaf. What does the forest whisper when nightingales are dumb and cicadas fall silent? The forest whispers, come. What does the forest whisper in sunshine and in shade? down every moss-hung alley, in each deer-haunted glade. What does the forest whisper when full or crescent moon steeps nodding crests in silver? The forest whispers, soon. What does the forest whisper from depths primeval where a sound is lost in stillness as clouds dissolve in air? What does the forest whisper when from the darkling bough drop one by one the dead leaves? The forest whispers now. But the whisper's a dream whisper, for years on years have flown since oak and ash and holly could call the land their own. The whisper's a dream whisper, for cities of the plain usurp the once green kingdom of forests they have slain. The whisper's a dream whisper, for forest is a dream of days when man through nature had sense of a supreme. The whisper's a dream whisper of a time when he could feel in the pressure of the actual the touch of the ideal. The whisper's a dream whisper, but dreams are of the soul, and soul itself a forest beyond the mind's control. The whisper's a soul whisper that, like a muffled drum, calls from your mind-built cities, O man, to freedom come. Thank you.
I will start with where Nikolai left it. Is the main aspect of my going forth at the moment, which is still alive, is being here at Padmaloka. And for me, there are just a few elements going forth from what and to what. I think before coming to Padmaloka, I was in France, working in my neat, comfortable life, working as a scientist, having a good job, being well paid, engaged with a French sangha, going at the Paris Buddhist Center three evening a night. I just moved in Paris to be closer to the sangha. I was doing a lot of coming and going to my job, to our connection. But I was really happy to set up my life in Paris. But I was still frustrated because most of my energy were going to work. And science was great. I like to think. I spend a lot of time with computers. But it was mostly about talking, having different opinions about dead matter. It's a bit harsh to say, but it was just what was the real impact of what I was doing was very small. I've been through already then a series of going forth, and I went 2 years in Africa working with people, four people trying to make a change in their life. And that flame of working to benefit people was really missing, and I was finding it in the Buddhist Center. So coming to Padma, I was there in a struggle, wanting to do something else, but without any outlet. I came about to ask for ordination just to try to become a teacher. It was my new career, becoming a teacher of the Dharma. And who was teaching the Dharma? All the members. So it was very self-centered project. Just I will become a teacher. It will be my living. And I went to Padmaloka, and then there I had my fourth sight, a mix of Padmavajra. I was in his group, and he said something about he was celebrating his birthday, 50, I don't know, something. And he said something about, if I had to live my life again, I would do it again. And I'm really he was confident in what he was doing and really wanted to share that and keep doing that. And that's, I was really impressed by that. I would like to have that quality, working with others, in a big project, the Padmaloka project. And then I was in a room with Ayabandhu, which then was still a Mitra, sharing a room with him, and I discovered that he was living at Padmaloka, and it was really the foresight. How come he lives in Padmaloka? He's just a Mitra. There was, at that time, mostly all the members on the community, only Sanghanista. Then it was not Sanghanista, Jonathan was working in the kitchen, but in my mind I said, well, all the members don't want to cook, so they put a little Mitra there, but otherwise the true things, the true people are all the members. You can't really be a Mitra. And just having a chat with Ayabandhu then, just, I want to do it. I just, there's no way I can't do that. If he can do it, I will do it. And I went to a phase of what I call fanatic Buddhism. It was really something, I found my goal at last, and I went for it. It's really going forth was really the word, going for it. And now, reflecting back, I was a bit reckless. A week after my retreat, I wrote to my parents, that's what I want to do with my life. I love you very much. Thank you. I'm doing that. And I wasn't able to really listen to them. And I still have to cope for the reaction. Trying to keep to reassure them, but I really love them and I want still to stay connected, but I want to do my own thing. But at that time, I didn't care. My work, 2 weeks after, I sent my resignation letter. People were really surprisingly supportive in my work because they had also a taste of a spirituality in their life, very different from Buddhism, but it was interesting to do that. And I engaged with the Padmaloka process of them to know me and me to discover what it is. And there was no guarantee, but six months later, I went and came to Padmaloka. Everything worked out, thankfully. I don't know what I will be doing, but I'm really grateful for that. But I didn't know what I was going for. I'm going in a foreign country, in a different language, physically away from my family, which was my life, my kind of emotional life. Away from career, away from money, and living and working with other people. That's the most challenging bit. Community is about living and working with other people. It sounds okay, it's nice, but I've been so used to live on my own, do my own thing, being the top of my own little world. Sharing and creating a world together is the strongest element of going forth living here. So that's kind of living at Padmaloka, kind of going for story. The other one is a bit more recent, is becoming an order member, is another kind of going forth. And it's encouraged to, I think for me, I really engage in that myth. There is a 4-month retreat at Gukyaloka, it's a retreat center in Spain. I really took seriously that I was living that life, living my old name, to become somebody else. And I make the choice to see everybody, sort my life out and say goodbye to everybody and then move on. But again, I didn't know what I was looking for. I know it was a positive thing to do. I've seen people, all the members really flourishing, people I really want to be like. How it manifested is, for example, the foresight for me was something... was Sadaloka. Sadaloka is my private preceptor, but he wasn't the person I was relating to as a preceptor before. I really like, for those who know, Padmavajra, kind of extroverted, giving strong talk, faith, engaging with people, really a kind of network person. That was the kind of the shiny aspect of the spiritual life I wanted. But living here, I discovered kind of the jewel of Sadaloka. Sadaloka means the light of faith. And he's basically almost a spiritual kind of, I don't have experience, the expression in English. Somebody is doing his job quietly, but a very kind mind, a very steady, and taking a huge lot of responsibility without showing it. He's moving soon away from Padmaloka after 18 years, and there's all his life here, his team, his friend, his family, and he's moving to Adishtana to become the chairman of a public preceptor college. It's one of the kind of body of people who basically give a direction to the order. He's 60-something, 64, and it's another going forth at his age. I'm really impressed by the fact that That's needed. That's not what he kind of particularly likes personally, but the movement needs him, and he can do it. And he has the good quality, and he goes for it. And it's this service, the kind of a man of service that I want to become more. The kind of is this kind of inner sense of worth rather than the extroverted. You know, both are really good, but that's really what inspired me in becoming another member. And going forth from another way, just so that was for Sada Loka. Another point I really like to emphasize on becoming another member is we have the Kesa, so we think it's something definite, but it's not. The ordination in Triratna is quite bizarre. It's nor monk nor lay. We don't fit into any category. Even in my family, when you talk to people, they just want to know what you are doing. And it's very difficult to express. And it's a kind of going forth. You're going forth from the nice way of presenting yourself with a kind of a name. You have to almost show yourself and help people discover what could be or what is an order member. And it's a committed life. Nowadays, I don't have time to go into detail, but committing our life to go for refuge in the free jewel, putting that at the center of our life, it's very challenging. Most of the center of life of people is career, family, children, and the free refugees in comparison seems to be selfish. It's the most unselfish way to do things in some ways. But last time I communicated with somebody, I said, right, no, I want to commit myself. I don't want a family. I don't want children. And then I said, oh, that's very selfish. Just yes, but it's another kind of relating to other beings, which is not immediate and not very easily understandable. So trying to discover that for oneself, not having any templates except the one of other members, each of them doing their own thing, is a good challenge. And it's a going forth to discovering what I am or what I could be. So that's Padmaloka, order member. What I want to conclude with, I want to evoke two things that Nikolai evoked a bit. There is the big story of going forth where, for example, I've decided to move to Padmaloka. So it seems a very willful kind of, there is a lot of self-power energy in going forth. But there is being at Padmaloka, living at Padmaloka was more a receptive aspect. There's a lot happening beyond the stage that I am not doing it. And becoming becoming part of the Padmaloka community was little by little helping me going away from feeling I am special. I remember a young men retreat here at Padmaloka where I had a foresight, and the foresight was very unusual. Sometimes we think foresight should be, you know, like Gandalf or kind of something big, kind of where it's written foresight. But sometimes it's just a newcomer. And it was two newcomers. If you know them, Lee and Nathan, which are kind of quite big, strong guy. And I was very wary of them. I was struggling with anger myself, at the end of the study group, one of the study group, we end up sharing, and I was very shamefully kind of expressing a bit of anger, and they shared their path, their journey with anger. And I realized there's no difference. There's a really strong connection. The foresight is really something which kind of shift my perspective of things. It's not that I had to do something else. It's living at Padmaloka, engaging with people. There is a click that kind of actualize something. And since then, I think it was my real beginning to engage in the ordination process on a kind of, a less self, kind of self-concerned way. And that's, it's still my working ground, moving away, going forth from being special to being human and engaging with people as they are. Time up, I think. There's a lot of things. Conclusion. Going forth for me, the more you look at it, and I think I invite you, later to reflect on that during the meditation and discuss that in the discussion cafe. But it's not something done in the past or a plan for the future. It's really an attitude to the present, a kind of a way that can help to make sense and give sense to the impermanent flow of our experience. Going forth is the creative man in action. Otherwise, we just stagnate. For me, going forth is an expression of the creative mind. That's what is alive at the moment. Thank you.